We're back in Chumash Bamidbar, and we're starting today Parshat Naso, the second Parsha in Sefer Bamidbar. To start off Parshat Naso is opposed to Parshat Bamidbar, is a much more varied Parsha. There's a lot more going on in the Parsha. There's a lot more topics that are addressed in the Parsha, and it's going to be a challenge for us both to try to link together all of those unique pieces and really come to understand the underlying themes, the larger concepts that stand behind Parshat Naso as a whole. So let's start out by outlining the major topics in Parshat Naso. I encouraged all of you over the weekend to read Parshat Naso. I hope you got a chance to. If you take a look, you open up in your Chumashim now, let's outline what are the major topics in Parshat Naso. Yeah, Marley. Good. So what we'll refer to as Pikudat Halevim. And as we mentioned before, we never answered the somewhat problematic question of why the charge of the Levim, the duties of the Levim, are divided between the end of Parshat Midbar and the beginning of Parshat Naso. We're going to leave that as an open question like we did there. We'll leave it here. We'll just refer to it as Pekudat Levim. Good. That's the first thing that the Parsha deals with is, uniquely, what the job is of the Mishpachot of Gershon and Merari in terms of their responsibilities to the Mishkan. Good. Next. What's the next topic? Begins in Perek Hay. Yeah. Good. Sending out those who are tameh, shiluach atmim minachaneh. We're sending out those who are tameh from this camp, from this encampment. What comes after the very next paragraph after we send out the tameim? The Hebrew here is a little bit difficult to decipher in terms of what the actual topic is. The literal next paragraph. We have a while till Nazir. Before then, can you guess that Tanakh? What's in the next paragraph? Perek Hey, Pasuk Hey. You can just read the shoulder caption, yes, if you want. Good, well, we'll write as, even in English, theft. Dealing with issues of theft within the context of the camp. It refers to it in a tricky term of lim'ol ma'al b'Hashem, and that would, I think, confuse matters. We'll refer to it as theft, which is the topic of the paragraph. Next paragraph, what comes after that? Now we get a little more straightforward to larger topics that go on for a nice chunk of the Parsha. Yeah, Gitti.
Yes.
Sota. What is the Sota? Or people, very basically, what is the Sota? So the Sota is, what? Yeah. When a woman, if she is suspected of straying, a married woman is suspected of straying with another man, if she is warned by her husband not to seclude herself with that man, and then there are two witnesses who see her seclude herself with him, they don't witness anything. They don't know what happened in seclusion. There's no definitive proof that any actual infraction happened. However, since she was warned by her husband, and then there were witnesses that, despite that warning, she did seclude herself with that man, they then go to the Beit HaMikdash. She goes through a very complicated and painful process where, step by step, she's pushed to admit that she sinned, where she's degraded to admit that she sinned. If she admits that she sinned, the two get divorced and that's it, that's the end of their marriage. If, on the other hand, she decides to go through with it, she then drinks the mei sota, which have many pieces to it, but one of them is the fact that God's name is written on the klala that will come to her, and that parchment is erased into the water. That's the well-known concept of that God is willing to have his name erased to establish Shalom Bayit. She then drinks the waters. If she didn't sin, well, let's do it the other way. If she did sin with that man, what happens? She explodes. Mifrash Pesukim. Not Mifrash Pesukim, the one who she committed adultery with also explodes. He doesn't get off scot-free. They're both done. If, on the other hand, she did not sin, what happens? She lives and what? She has a bracha, but very specifically, she is guaranteed to have a child with her husband, which is very interesting. She's guaranteed to have a child with her husband. But in any event, it's dealing with this issue of a woman who it's not clear if she strayed from her husband. Again, Chazal understand that both the adulterer and the adulteress definitely experience the punishment for this, even though it's the woman who has to go through the process. Sidebar, while this often gets a lot of flack because only the woman goes through this process, just to note that Chazal are very open about the fact that the reason why they put her through this torturous process is twofold. Number one is because... Right, well, you could, yes, she made a bad choice, but that's a lot to put her through, and, you know, it's still a lot to put her through for having done that. Is number one is that we don't want to erase God's name, very simply, and I think much more deeply and meaningfully also. No, that's not true. They're both very meaningful, they're both very deep. But equally as deep and meaningful is that the goal is to save her life. Because if she's just afraid to admit that she actually did commit adultery, and she does drink the water, and she was guilty, then that's it. So they're being as harsh on her as they are in order to attempt to save her life. And that perspective, unfortunately, very often gets lost in the shuffle of trying to fight for this woman who may be an adulteress. So just keeping perspective that there's a respect for godliness and a respect for human life, which drives the reality of the sota. Yeah.
It is public, yes.
It's public to, right, to try to convince her to finally break and just say, like, let this end, I did it, the end, I'm willing to move on. If she's able to just very quietly, behind closed doors, stand by her principles, when she may actually just be, she may be guilty, then she could end up losing her life for it. It's also meant as a warning, and we'll get to that in a second. What's the next paragraph? Nazir. A nazir is when a man or a woman takes upon themselves to enter some sort of elevated level of holiness and separate from certain things in the physical world. Specifically, anybody aware of what the major things that a nazir separates him or herself from? Wine or any derivation of grapes. Two, cutting their hair. And three, and coming anywhere near a dead body. They completely separate themselves from tumat meat. Those are the three primary things. They stand on an elevated level of kiddusha. That's the nazir. What's next in the parsha? See why we have a lot to kind of link together here. Louder. Birkat kohanim. And then finally, which takes up basically the whole end of the parsha, the nice chunk at the end of the parsha. That earlier? Excellent. We have the korbanot of the Nisim, where each tribe presents a dedication to the Mishkan with the ultimate goal of what? Where does the Parsha actually conclude? What's the end point of the Parsha? Where does it come to its culmination in? Moshe goes to Ohel Moed and God speaks to Moshe. How is that pasuk phrased? Let's see if we can get that a little, clarify that definition a little bit further. This is the last pasuk of the parsha. Vo Moshe el Ohel Moed ledaber itov vayishmata kol medaber elav mi'al hakaporet asher al aron ha'idud min shnei hakrovim vayidaber elav. That this is that moment This is that moment where the Shekhinah first enters into the Mishkan, and then this is the first time that God speaks to Moshe from between the two Kruvim that stand at the center of the Mishkan. Meaning that somehow what then, which even already begins to transition this Parsha, the Ohel within the Mishkan is referred to as Ohel Moed. Is referred to as Ohel Moed. I could be wrong. I believe that until the Mishkan was built, God spoke through Moshe's tent itself, and Moshe's tent was referred to as Ohel Moed, I believe. And that's why his oil is moved to the outside of the camp after Parshat Ki Tisa, before they build the Mishkan. But I believe at this point in time, Ohel Moed is the actual inside of the Mishkan, which contains the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadosh. If that's what happens, I'm not going to even put it down. If that's what happens, that's the last pasuk. How could we reframe this parsha, knowing that that's the concluding pasuk? What seems to be the goal of what we're trying to get to? What seems to be the goal of what Parshat Naso is geared toward, trying to achieve? Sometimes we can look at the first pasuk in the first paragraph. Sometimes we can look at the last pasuk in the last paragraph. Sof maaseh b'machshavah tchila. What's the end point that we're building towards? A little bit more clearly, refine it. Refine it. I'm agreeing with you, yes, but refine it. Good. We're going to try to pull all those together. What we're trying to get to at the end, what happens in that last moment, in that critical moment, is Hashra'at HaShchinah. The Shekhinah actually enters into the Mishkan. That's what happens at that moment. That's the goal. And somehow, everything in this Parsha then must be leading toward the ultimate goal of Hashra'at HaShchinah in the Mishkan. If that's the concluding pasuk, that's where everything must be aimed toward. As it says here at the beginning of the Korbanot HaNesim, in the beginning of Perek Zayin, Vayihi biyom kalot Moshe lehakim et hamishkan. On the day where Moshe finished putting up the Mishkan, Vayimshach oto, and he put the oil over the Mishkan, Vayikadesh oto ve'et kol kelav, etc. When is this happening? What date is this occurring on? If you were here last semester, you know this date. If you were here two semesters ago, you know this date. What? Aleph Nisan. Aleph Nisan of the second year in the desert. Excellent. This is the third time we're coming back to this date, the day where the Mishkan went up, which is Aleph Nisan of the second year in the desert. We've visited it. We visited this day on the Shemot level, which is the last Parsha in Sefer Shemot. All of Sefer Shemot is geared toward getting us out of Mitzrayim to receive the Torah, to eventually build that bayit with Hashem that is the Mishkan. We visited it on the Vayikra level, where Parsha Shmini defines for us what it means to enter into deeper realms of Tahara and Kiddushah, which is the backbone of the Sefer. And this day is the third day, This is the same day for the third time, and the third Sefer on a totally different level, that we're re-examining this day. Aleph Nisan of the second year. And at the end of that process, once all of the Korbanot and Nesi'im are brought, then, like in both of the previous books, whether it's in Shemot, where the Anan Hashem comes and is Maleat HaMishkan, or whether it's in Parshat Shmini and Sefer Vayikra, where the Eish comes in and fills the Mishkan. So here, now God is coming and speaking through the Mishkan Bin HaKruvim at the end of the Parsha. The goal is to get Hashra'at HaShchinah to the Mishkan. And if that's true, everything in Parshat Naso is geared toward that goal. How do we get the reality of Hashra'at HaShchinah into the Mishkan? All of these pieces have to fit toward that goal. thinking about it in the context of what we've built so far. What was Parshat Bamidbar all about? So what we said was that Parshat Bamidbar had these two first main points. The first one is the rise of each individual. The rise of each individual. And the uniqueness of each individual within the context of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, we count each individual, we give them their goal, we give them their tafkid through the pikudim, and then we arrange them in a camp. And there are four different areas of that encampment in the desert. But what we saw through both the content and the structure of Parshat Bamidbar, it's not just they're put in four different encampments. They're not just spread out by into all four winds of the earth, into all four corners of the earth. But rather, what are they doing? By dividing up into four, how are they structured in a structure of four? Around the Mishkan. We get that structure from Bamidbar. We understand that this is how Klal Yisrael are going to situate themselves, who they are and where they are. That they're identified as unique individuals, and that makom somehow needs to be around this centerpiece called the Mishkan. But now that we have this machaneh of these individuals, the question of Parshat Naso is how do we transform this machaneh from being a machaneh? The structure is there, but the content isn't there. How do we go from being a machaneh to creating what is our key phrase for Parshat Naso? How do we create a machaneh shechinah? Not just a machaneh, not just an encampment, not just some area where the Jews are situated. How do we go from being a machaneh to being paradigmatically, being the essence of a machaneh shechinah? A machaneh that can be permeated by the shechinah, where the shechinah can enter, and a machaneh where the shechinah travels with us for all time. That's the background to our parsha. And with that background, we can start to pull together, all too briefly, the different parts of this parasha. Leaving out this Pikudat HaLevi'im piece, it's the second part of this two-part that seems to cross over the border of these two parshiot. Let's start immediately from number two. What was number two? Shiluach HaTzmeim. How does Shiluach HaTzmeim encounter, help create a machaneh shechinah? That we need to remove the tme'im, that by the removal of tme'ah, we create a reality that can hold the shechinah. Very simply, that's almost the most direct cause and effect. And that's why we start there. It's the most obvious thing to start with. That if we're going to create a machaneh shechinah, a machaneh for which is going to have HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, Kiddusha Mamash, rest within it, then we need to remove that which is tme'. And so we remove the tme'im from the context of the machaneh. Stage one. Theft. Why do we bring up the issue of theft? Dishonesty. It's a bad thing. There's a lot of things that are dishonest. Why theft? Giving instead of taking. Nice, good. Yeah?
You'd be taking care of the Bein Adam Mechaveiro first, who then bring Hashem
also. Interesting. I wouldn't have then started with Shiluach HaTzmeim, because that's a more godly issue than theft, but it could be that maybe they're two sides of the same coin. Could be. Yeah?
I just think that these are less likely to just come out and say, like, oh, I'm a thief. So, like, you kind of have to, like, weed them out specifically, and then, like, kind of, like, leads right into the social, because they're even more difficult to weed out, because they're
even more unclear. Interesting. We definitely want to come back to that point with Sota. I like that. I like all of the thoughts. There's definitely a lot of good thinking going here. I want to share with you one approach of the Or Gedaliah that I saw, which helped clarify it for me, which is not to negate anything that was said here before. The Or Gedaliah points out very beautifully that what's the issue with theft in the context of Sefer Bamidbar, both in terms of it as a sefer and also in terms of this establishment of a machaneh shechinah. When I steal something, what am I really saying? Right? I come and I look around and I say, you know what? You don't deserve this. I want this. This should be mine. I'm taking this. Sorry. Next topic. No, I'm kidding. What am I saying by taking this? I'm jealous of them, which implies that it what? Could be mine, or that it should be mine. This should be mine. Why should Shandy have this beautiful, glorious, very fancy schmancy Pirkei Avot that shines and glistens in the sun, right? With this fancy cover. I deserve this. This is, who are you to, why should you get this? It's not me. And I'm going to take this because this really belongs to me. You shouldn't have gotten this. I should have. And it denies the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is guiding the world and gives every single person what they need. It denies God's intention by each person's individuality, which was the premise of Sefer Bamidbar, of Parshat Bamidbar. Bamidbar was the rise of each individual with their own unique tafkid. I have my own goal and I have what I need to do that goal. With my own makom, I have the space that I need to accomplish what I need to accomplish. But theft is antithetical to Bamidbar. Theft is antithetical to a recognition of what an individual is all about. That if Shandy has this Sefer, it's because she needs that for her Avodas Hashem. And if I don't have that, I don't need that for my Avodas. I need that Pirkei Avos for my Avodas Hashem. I don't need that Pirkei Avos for my Avodas Hashem. And if I go and steal it, I deny my very individuality. And I destroy a Machane Shechina. I destroy a Machane where there's a recognition that it's the Shechina that's guiding it, that's part of it, that's here, and that everything that's happening is happening under Hashkachat Hashem. Theft is the premise that there is no God, that there is no godliness guiding the world. There is no divine presence guiding the world. A denial of the tafkid that God gives me, of the things that God gives me, and that God has given me everything that I need to fulfill my own tafkid. And so we need to remove theft from the machane. Because the machane, as this harmony of different aspects, can't function if I don't respect my place within that machane. If I covet your objects, if I covet your space, then I'm coveting your identity and I can't feel my identity within the machane. And I push the Shekhinah out of the machane. Yeah?
Also, like, when you're stealing from someone, that's not just like taking, like you're stealing from like no one else sees you.
It's also not so clear. How do you know it's not mine? You're saying that it's something which you can't know, you can't inherently know. I mean, unless Shandy's got her name in the front cover. Which is smart, because I might steal it. Then how would you know what's really going on? Which we'll see. Comes somebody else said that as well. We're going to swing that back into the Sota in a second. Then comes the Sota and the Nazir, which are interesting in terms of why they would need to be brought up in this context. My Rebbe has one suggestion of why they're here in the establishment of Machane Shechina, and I have a totally opposite suggestion as to why they're part of the establishment of Machane Shechina. And I'll present you with both, and you can choose. Okay? My Rebbe suggests the following, which is that as we establish this camp, what we actually even need to do is we need to remove, or we need to identify, or we need to establish a relationship with the extremes within the Machane. What's the Sota the extreme of? Tuma, negativity. This is an extreme Tuma within the Machane. It's the worst Tuma that there is, a Tuma in the realm of Arayot. And how do we deal with Tuma in the realm of Arayot in the context of the Machane? How do, in this Machane Shechina? On the flip side, what is the Nazir? Extreme Kedusha. Separating entirely from wine, not getting near Tumat Mate, not cutting my hair. I'm totally elevating myself for a certain amount of time. I'm raising myself up. And so the Machane has to deal with its own extremes. And that's why we have to deal with the Sota and the Nazir in that context. Yeah?
Well, why we have to deal with the Nazir is not a good extreme.
It is, but it's an intense extreme.
Don't want it to, but
it's interesting. The Gemara actually struggles with the Nazir. And the Gemara says it's interesting. When the Nazir is done being a Nazir, the Nazir has to bring a chatat, a sin offering. Which is odd. If they're a Nazir, well, that's a good thing. Well, they have to bring a sin offering. And one of the suggestions is because one says, well, they have to bring a chatat because they're stopping to be a Nazir and they're leaving that Kedusha behind. Or on the flip side is, no, they're to bring a chatat because while they were in the midst of being a Nazir, they separated themselves from wine. And to deny yourself a part of God's world is something which is deserving of a chatat. Very interesting way of looking at it. So it's definitely an extreme. There's something extreme there. Not only is there something extreme there, the connection between a sota and a nazir, Chazal identify as being actually a reaction of extremes. Anybody familiar with what the connection is between a sota and a nazir and why they're placed next to each other?
Someone sees a sota.
Excellent. You basically quoted Chazal in English. Excellent. That a person, that Chazal said, why are sota and nazir connected to each other? Why are they placed next to each other in these parshiot? Because if one goes by and one happens to be going to the Beit HaMikdash that day, and when they walk into the Beit HaMikdash, what do they see? A woman who's being dealt with as a sota. But that's a signal to that individual, a warning to that person, that they're seeing that for a reason. They're seeing that because maybe there's something problematic within themselves. And since that problem may exist within themselves, they should take it upon themselves to separate themselves from wine. Because maybe they can handle it and they might end up being in a sota situation should they end up getting drunk. That seeing the sota is a warning to stay away from wine.
Wasn't it done in public?
Yeah.
So then everyone...
Not everyone saw it in public. They didn't have live broadcasts back then. There were certain people who were in the Beit HaMikdash that day. And the point is, if you happen to have been there on the day of a sota, that was God orchestrating things, because it's a machaneh shechina, God orchestrating things that you saw the sota to warn you that you might have to worry about sota issues, and therefore you should make sure to separate yourself from wine. Which again emphasizes this concept of it being a machaneh shechina, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is maneuvering all of those pieces bashkacha inside to make sure that everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing. So if the extreme in Arayos is the sota, and we want to keep ourselves from being within the sota context, we then have to jump to the other extreme, which is the nazir, and hence my Rebbe's focus on these two being extremes. Are you already clear on that approach as to how to, it's dealing with these extremes within inside of the machaneh? Questions on that? Yeah.
So is it just dealing with extremes, or is it extremes?
I think it's giving them context as to what to do with them. Meaning, how do you deal with a sota if you have a sota? How does the nazir deal with the reality of their nizirut and what happens if they do come across a dead body? What should they stay away from now? They shouldn't stay away from it. Like, how do we deal with those extremes that exist within the camp? I want to present an alternative. Take it or leave it. My Rebbe presented this as one possibility. He said he's not convinced that it's necessarily true, and I suspect that it actually might be the exact opposite. I don't think these are extremes at all. I think these are the opposite of extremes. And I think that I suspect that it actually flows much better with the Parsha not to look at them as extremes. What I think we're doing is we're moving into more finer and finer and more nuanced levels of how to create a Machaneh Shechina. The first thing is super obvious. Get rid of the Tum'ah. Okay. You want to create a machaneh shechina, get rid of tuma. Then we get to something that's a little bit more tricky. We have to remove from the context of the machaneh anybody who doesn't understand what a machaneh shechina is. That's theft. If you don't get how this functions, if you don't understand that the way that a machaneh shechina functions is with everybody fulfilling their own unique tafkid, we have a problem. But what happens then when we get to areas of the machaneh that themselves are inherently murky? Tum'ah, take out. Theft, it's murky, like somebody pointed out before, I think it was Ariella. You're not sure, you don't know, did somebody steal, did they not steal? You could do it very quietly, you could do it very secretly, who knows if somebody stole or didn't steal. I think the sota and the nazir are going into even more finer and finer levels of dealing with the really gray areas of the machaneh. Because what really is a sota? What is a sota? What do we know about her? Nothing. We don't know anything. Who said that? Excellent. We don't know nothing about her. Yeah, I was very clear on that. I don't know anything about the Sota. That's why she's a Sota. I know that she was warned. I know she went into seclusion. But I don't actually know anything about what happened. So how do I deal with possible Tum'ah? Did it happen? Did it happen? Well, if it happened, then we have to get her out of the Malchareh. If it happened, we have a problem. But if it didn't happen, then nothing happened. So how do I deal with a lack of clarity about Tum'ah? And then the most fine area of Avodah, what if I have a question mark about Kedusha itself, which I think is inherently the nature of the Machloket in that Gemara? Is a Nazir Kadosh, or is a Nazir a Chote? That's basically what Gemara is asking. The Nazir has to bring a Chatat for one of two reasons. Either because they're so super spiritual for this period of time, and now that it's over, they're going to come crashing back down into the regular normalcy of our mundane lives. That Nazir put himself up on a pedestal. He's super Kadosh. Or we say, no, he's not super Kadosh. It's Machloket the Gemara. He's not Kadosh. A human being, a Jew, is meant to engage the physical world and elevate the spiritual within the physical. And that Nazir has to bring a Chatat. It's very nice that he couldn't handle wine, but a Jew is meant to overcome their Ta'avot and deal with the physical world and engage it meaningfully and be Megaleh, reveal the godliness in every facet of the physical world. So which one is he? Is he super spiritual? Or is he absent because he can't deal with spirituality? Question mark. Machloket about the Nazir. Those are two opposites. So I suspect that actually what's happening here, and again, not to contradict Mary, Mary posted as a possibility, but as sitting there and thinking about it and trying to pull it together in a narrative in a different way, I think we're actually getting into finer and finer details, getting rid of the Tme'im on, perhaps as somebody pointed out, maybe the issues of Tum'ah on a Beinat al-Makom level, and then maybe issues of lack of clarity on the Chavira level, but then getting into an Avodas Hashem, a Sota, lack of clarity within Tum'ah, and then even lack of clarity within Kiddusha. How do we deal with that to make sure that we have a Machaneh Shekhinah that can encompass all of those things? Which takes us all the way to Birkat Kohanim and the Korbanot Nesi'im. To fully understand in my mind how to deal with Birkat Kohanim and the Korbanot Nesi'im, we're going to have to open up this term. We've now explained far too briefly and without going into any of them too, you know, specifically enough, what links this parsha together. And we define it as Machaneh Shekhinah. What we're going to do on Wednesday is blow open this term of what a Machaneh Shekhinah is. What does it really mean? What does it mean to have a Machaneh Shekhinah? What does it mean that we have a Machaneh Shekhinah, which is the way that we travel throughout the world, not just through the 40 years of the desert, but as a paradigm for how we're meant to travel throughout the world for all of Jewish history? So on Wednesday, we're going to open up this term of a Machaneh Shekhinah, which will hopefully then add much deeper, richer content, which will pull the last parts of this parsha together for us hopefully by the end of Wednesday. And with that, we'll conclude our very brief discussion of Parshat Naso. So we'll pick up then.